All right, one of my favorite pods of the year is upon us. The one that we do wrapping up all 8 game ones from the first round. A lot of games have built up. We're looking forward to getting to these. Before that, though, I want to encourage you to do our survey. We're very close, actually, to setting pretty much a record on response rate. The highest that they usually get is 8%. We are right about there. So if we get up to 10%, that would be unbelievable. The link for that, podsurvey.com/capspace. But without further ado, let's get to some games. Indiana at Toronto. It was a comfortable for Pacers fans and incredibly disturbing for Toronto fans victory for the Pacers, 100-90. And the place to start here, I mean, we could talk a lot about Casey and the adjustments and the substitutions and all that, but the crux of the matter is, if Paul George is going to be by far the best player on the floor and score 33 points on very efficient shooting, and Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan are going to go a combined 8-32, it doesn't matter what Dwayne Casey does in this series.
Yeah, I was struck during this game with the idea, I think it gets overhyped about two-way players and the distinction of, oh, this guy's a two-way player, but in this game, Paul George made a massive impact on both ends of the floor, and was, you talked about him being the best player on the floor, but there's a difference between that and, let's say, what James Harden does, because he was a substantially positive offensive player and made one of the linchpins of Toronto completely ineffective.
Yeah, George only played 37 minutes, actually, but when you consider, and I was critical of Vogel for not playing him more, but when you consider that he matched up pretty much in all of his minutes with DeMar DeRozan, who actually only played 37 minutes himself, and nearly completely erased him from the game. You know, this was, and this seemed to be true at least for one day of games, for almost all the games, almost exactly what we kind of had foreseen a little bit happen, but just even to a larger extreme in this one, right? Like, George completely shut down DeRozan. On the other side, Toronto had nobody to guard Paul George, and he went off like crazy. Kyle Lowry struggled against George Hill. He played 41 minutes, so it was 3 out of 13 from the field. Only had 10 points and 6 turnovers, which was even worse, only 7 assists. And continues to really struggle shooting the ball. 1 out of 7 from 3, 4 out of 9 from the free throw line for Lowry. You really, you know, we said that kind of since that news came out that he had his elbow drained, he hasn't been quite right. And whether it's the elbow or he's tired or he's just had bad games, he's had one good game since like March 18th, I think. So it's just, it's not good for Toronto right now. What is your level of panic 1 to 10 if you're a Raptors fan right now?
Probably about an 8, because a lot of the things that happened, yeah, they could mitigate those, but the flaws are going to still exist. And if Lowry, it seems unlikely that he's going to really get that much better, though there is more rest now than during the regular season. But there are things that they can improve, like, for example, usage of a couple of different guys, Patterson and Damari Carroll probably being among them. Of course, Carroll is limited with injury. And also, I would say, using Norman Powell better.
Yeah, that might be one, too. And you could also say, yeah, Paul George was good, but his performance is probably going to decline. He was 6 out of 8 from mid-range, and then he was 4 out of 5 on threes. Indiana overall, 11 out of 21 on threes. This is a team that was in the mid-20s in offense this year by points per possession. So I do think they could certainly defend better, even just due to regression of the mean. But yeah, there, you also have to wonder, you know, whether Dwayne Casey is going to make the adjustments at all. We're pretty obvious to just about everyone on basketball Twitter. Sometimes those don't work out, but I think these are pretty obvious. And where do we want to start with what those are?
I actually want to start with one that's on defense that just shocked me, was that DeRozan was guarding Paul George most of the time. We can talk about it the other way, but just he can't do anything on Paul George.
Yeah, oh, you're talking about defense?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how many times does DeRozan have to prove that he can't guard good three men in the playoffs? And you know, this is another indication of George able to just kind of get wherever he wanted, shoot right over the top on DeRozan. Casey went with the starting lineup that he's been using, which included Norman Powell. And a lot of what George was getting on those mid-rangers, he was just coming off of a screen, DeRozan or Domari Carroll too, who does not look like himself physically, you know, would just kind of be trailing, and then they would always run it to Valanciunas' side, and Valanciunas, you know, is not the kind of guy who has the craft needed to both step up and help on a pin down like that, and also, like, still prevent the pass to what kind of becomes the role man. You know, if you think about it, after he sets the screen, you're going to cut hard to the basket on that pin down. So, you know, that's a play that they really have a lot of trouble with. I think that Norman Powell, among everyone on the team, is probably the best equipped to just get into George's body, create more space around that screen, and just stay with him so that the big does not have to help. You know, that was a play that they had a lot of trouble with. And Powell, I mean, due to his length and athleticism, I mean, I think he's not going to be any worse than DeRozan at contesting Paul George. And then the other thing, too, DeRozan obviously has a tough task going against George, and we'll get to how miserable his night was in a second. But at least now you're not tiring him out as well. You know, at least, also, I mean, another thing you can do, too, is try to get DeRozan out there for whenever PG is not out there. Because Indiana doesn't really have any other great options defending on the wing. Do you want to talk about DeRozan now? You kind of went through all of his shots, and it didn't look good.
Yeah, I woke up early this morning, and for whatever reason, I was compelled, even though we watched the game, to rewatch all of DeRozan's shooting possessions. And what struck, there were two things that struck me. One, almost all of the looks were bad looks. You know, they were contested, whether it was by Paul George or somebody else, Rodney Stuckey, Miles Turner blocked a couple of them, which I'd like to talk about a little bit later. And also, a fair amount of them had plenty of time on the shot clock. So you can, that kind of says two things. One is, you know, maybe these shots shouldn't be taken, and there will always be those grenades or flaming bags, whatever you want to call them, where somebody has to take a bad shot. But a lot of these were not that, and it was, you could call it settling or you could call it something else. And that's concerning, because that's more about judgment than about, you know, desperation or not creating the opportunity.
How many good shots would you say of his 19?
So I think you could go as high as 5, but I think that's about as high as you could go.
Yeah, and this is a guy, you know, he's a bad shot maker, right?
Yeah.
And we talked, it was funny, actually, we said in the preview that PG has the length to kind of stay down on his pump fakes. And of course, the first play of the game, he gets PG in the air with a pump fake and gets a foul. But after that, PG was absolutely superlative. You know, there's just, PG's more athletic, he's longer. There's just, you know, those long twos are just going to be totally contested. I mean, even like some of the shots he did make, like just a crazy fadeaway on the baseline with the shot clock coming down, like splaying his legs out, you know, that's probably like a 25% shot that he made. He also, you know, he's not going to be shooting a ton of threes,
well,
either,
yeah, like,
spacing out.
Like,
so he can't get the ball on like a closeout situation either after, and that Toronto doesn't move the ball enough to where you can run something else, force George to help, and then pass it over to DeRozan where he might be in an advantage situation.
Yeah, I know. I started noticing it in the later ones that when he actually got some switches, his best offensive play of the game was actually he got a switch and was on and Jordan Hill was on him, and he smoked Jordan Hill and got a dunk. And then you start realizing, oh yeah, that didn't happen at all because Paul George was just always there. So they weren't getting effective. And actually, a lot of his better looks early on were Biombo set better screens and created a little bit of separation. He was able to use that. Another one he got, Jan Mahinmi, was he was trailing on a switch, but he was just behind the play and he got a nice layup there. And so they're going to have to do a lot of that. There was also one where Kyle Lowry actually set a screen for DeRozan off the ball and created a little bit of separation. DeRozan ended up missing that shot because it was a nice contest, but they're going to have to make those separations and create a, you know, a little bit of a window that Paul George or whoever else isn't there, because when he's there, DeRozan, those are hard shots to make.
The other aspect, just besides the DeRozan issue, that we had looked at very closely coming in, was the battle of the big men. And I think there are a couple of aspects to this that were really interesting. One was Toronto really, really struggled to deal with the length of the Pacers inside Mahinmi, and especially Miles Turner, who had 5 blocks, were both fantastic. And just time after time, even, you know, you would have Lowry drive in, not be able to find anything, have to just snake along the baseline, throw it back out, and then Toronto, you know, wouldn't necessarily have the shooting to make them pay in those situations either. So that was also pretty concerning for Toronto. I mean, the one place that Toronto did well to me was on the offensive glass.
Well, yeah, I mean, it helps a little bit when you're missing a ton of shots, but Valanciunas in particular was just a beast on the offensive glass, particularly in the first, even though he was in foul trouble and only played 21 minutes, he really did make an impact on the game.
Yeah, he had 11 offensive rebounds, 9 in the first half, although a few of those were kind of endless tip sequences that he ended up not converting. And it's worth noting that although the Raptors overall had 20 offensive rebounds, they only had 17 second chance points. And generally, offensive rebounds are plays that you're going to convert at a pretty high rate. So a lot of that total was inflated just kind of by tips. And especially early on in the first half, they really weren't able to take a ton of advantage. The Raptors were also only 4 of 19 from 3. Although Lowry is not a great shooter, he took 7 right now with the elbow. He took 7 of those. The bigger number there is only the 19. That is not enough 3-point attempts. Indiana did an excellent job of preventing 3-pointers. I mean, I do think they need to continue to attack on the offensive glass, though, because Miles Turner is not really an adequate defensive rebounder. He only had 2 in 26 minutes. He'll chase after shots for blocks, which, you know, he was obviously awesome at. But then, you know, he just doesn't have the strength at this point in his career to deal with someone like Valanciunas boxing him out on the offensive glass.
And something that we've talked about before that I assume they'll adjust to over the course of the series is that there were a couple I saw with DeRozan and a few with some other guys where they just, Turner's length is surprising. And so he just gets to shots that people don't think he's going to get to. And I think at least 2 or 3 of the blocks were in that circumstance where the guy thought he had enough space and they didn't. So you would expect that when you face the same opponent again and again, that you will get a better sense of how much real estate you need.
The other thing we were looking at was kind of both these teams starting conventional bigs, Scola and Lavoie Allen, who is going to blink first. And I was impressed with Vogel that he did not ever go back to the two bigs. CJ Miles looked really good in his time as well. They went back to that lineup with Miles at the 4, Solomon Hill. It was basically either Miles or Hill playing at the 4 nearly the entire time once Allen would go out of the game after like 6 minutes had gone by in the first and third. And I'm impressed with Vogel because even when they're getting killed in the offensive glass, he still stuck with that strategy and just, you know, dealt with it basically. I mean, Allen is a good rebounder. He had, you know, I think 6 defensive rebounds in, you know, his 12 minutes or whatever it was that he played. But Vogel still didn't worry about that. He, I think, perhaps rightly realized that the biggest kind of bottleneck for Indiana in this series is going to be scoring. And so going small really helped a lot with that too. But if I were Vogel, I would just continue to start Allen, not even because I think it's the best approach, but just because that'll encourage Dwayne Casey to keep starting Luis Scola.
Yeah, and Scola doesn't really, to me, he doesn't have a place in this series, because one of the ways that I like to think about...
To me, he doesn't have a place in basically any series.
That's true. That's probably more accurate. Is the idea of competitive advantage. So what does a guy do that makes it easier for you to win basketball games? So there are a million different things that a guy can do, be good at, passing, shooting, blocking shots. Scola doesn't bring a lot of the big man advantages, and he brings all of the big man disadvantages. So the more he's on the court, the less you get all of the positives from other guys.
Yeah, they're not going to go to him in the post. He's developed an okay corner three at this point. And in his defense, he was only -1 in his 15 minutes tonight. But that said, I mean, this is the Raptors are supposed to have the talent advantage in this series. Like, they shouldn't be throwing away minutes where, you know, their best players aren't on the floor. And especially because the combination of he and Valanciunas is just too slow. When, you know, we talked about those George pin downs. When you've got Valanciunas and you've got Scola on the floor, you can go to either side with those pin downs and basically probably get an open shot for George if the initial defender gets picked off because the big is just not going to be mobile enough to help out on that play. So, I mean, the other kind of fail then is that if Scola is going to play 15 minutes, then Patterson is only going to play 28. He was 4 of 5 from the field. The only Raptor who was in the positive, he was +1. He provides a really solid spacing, had 3 offensive rebounds, actually. He's just a way better player than Luis Scola. And part of the reason that his minutes had to be down is because when you leave Scola in for 7 minutes, Now you've got to play Patterson the remaining 17 minutes of the half. And it's just, it seems like absolute lunacy to me to start a player who is never going to come back in, which is what happens with Scola. You know he's not the best player. So why are you playing him 15 minutes against what is theoretically the best unit from the other team?
Also, it completely screws with the rest patterns. We've talked before about how I think both of us agree that if you're going to play a guy meaningful minutes, it's good to give him two rest spots, and two is a whole lot more than zero. I mean, you're going to get natural breaks because of stoppages, but it doesn't do Patterson any favors, it doesn't do the rest of the team any favors to play it that way where you sit the first seven and then play the rest.
Corey Joseph also had 18 points on 5 of 6 from the field and 7 of 8 from the line, and he only played 24 minutes in this one, too. You know, so if you... Now, granted, it's not the greatest series for him in some ways, because now if you're playing him and you're playing Lowry, you're pushing DeRozan to the 3, and now he's got to potentially guard Paul George, although then maybe you can get Carroll in as well at the 4, and DeRozan can just guard either C.J. Miles or Solomon Hill. But, you know, clearly Joseph deserved more time. Terrence Ross, on the other hand, I think is someone who should probably be out of the rotation to me. I mean, here's how I'd be doing it if I were Casey. I'm starting Patterson. If I feel like Damari Carroll just doesn't have it, I will start Powell. I'll just go with Powell on Paul George to start. See how that works. I'm going to then not play Ross hardly at all unless there's foul trouble. I'm going to not play Scola hardly at all. And then your guys off the bench are Carroll, Biombo, and Joseph. Basically an 8-man rotation unless there's foul trouble or an emergency. And that's the way I would go, I think.
And I would also try to invert, if you can, invert Lowry and DeRozan just to try to get DeRozan off of Paul George. I think I would probably take a quick hook on DeRozan, you know, bounce that a little bit earlier and then have him close and start the quarters. Just something to get a little bit of separation.
Yeah, maybe what you would even, because usually the point that was made by KP and others was, all right, if you're going to play DeRozan at the start of the second quarter, which is or in the start of the fourth quarter when George usually gets his rest, now you're messing up the chemistry of a unit that's been really good, which is Lowry with all their bench guys. And if that's the case, I think what you do is, all right, just play DeRozan with those guys instead of Ross. And then, you know, maybe what you can do is you're going to take, I mean, I guess the problem then is that, you know, when do you rest Lowry? You don't want to have both of those guys off the floor at the same time, which is actually what Casey did at one point in the second quarter. So maybe what you would do is you rest DeRozan pretty early on, then have DeRozan come back in with maybe, you know, 3 minutes left in the first and third. That's when Lowry takes his break. Then you leave DeRozan in until Paul George comes back in. Then you take him out, sit him for another 3 minutes and get him his rest that way, you know, you want him on the bench when George is out there, both because he is a wing guy who can't guard George and because, of course, George just completely destroys him on defense.
That is exactly what I do. And as I responded to Mr. Pelton at the time, I think that I agree with him that the continuity is important in chemistry. This team has been together the whole year. But in a circumstance that where somebody is capable, in these rare circumstances where somebody can neutralize a player as important to their success as DeRozan, those are the times that you have to do it, because otherwise you're just so much more likely to fail. So I appreciate the sentiment and I agree with it a vast majority of the time, but there are exceptions that prove the rule.
Yeah, for me on the panic level for Toronto, I'm probably going about a 7. Monte Ellis is not going to go 3 of 4 from 3. He was, I thought, pretty bad in this game, other than the fact that he just happened to make his 3s. On fast breaks, I believe he was 0 for 4 on layups and had a turnover. And actually, I think either 3 or 4 of those plays turned into Toronto layups going the other way. That happens a lot when you miss a fast break layup and just go careening into the stands. If he had just actually converted on some of those plays, it could have been even worse. Solomon Hill somehow was 10 out of 10 from the free throw line. You know, I don't see him getting to the foul line quite that much. It was an unevenly refereed game. Our Bob Bulgaris noted that the last 13 road playoff games, or in the last 13 playoff games Scott Foster has officiated, the road team has won, which is pretty insane. And he had some rough calls on Valanciunas in particular. JVL only played 21 minutes.
Was that his third call that really stood out as being ridiculous? His third JV's?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The over the backbreaker.
Yeah.
you know, which for those who are new listeners, that's an offensive foul when you're in the penalty. So you're on a rebound. So you're immediately then walking to the other end to shoot free throws. One of like the most damaging plays you could have in the game. But on this one, it didn't look like too ridiculous to me. And Valanciunas, of course, fouled out as well once things were kind of in hand. So yeah, I think it's not the end of the world for Toronto yet. I think their defense can be a lot better. I also think that they can take advantage of the minutes when Ty Lawson is in and George Hill is out. George Hill only played 31 minutes and Lawson played 17. That to me is complete insanity. Like, George Hill needs to be playing at least 35, 36 minutes, especially to match up with Lowry. And I think, yeah, that the Toronto bench unit that's killed all year is going to start doing better against this bench for Indiana.
Yeah, I agree with just about all that.
All right, before we move on, I want to tell you about maybe our most important sponsor ever, which is us. We really want you to do this survey a huge favor for us. You're kind enough to listen to us for a few hours a week, but we want to ask for 3 minutes of your time to fill out this survey. That the higher the response rate we get, the better we can do with advertisers. And also, one person who fills it out will get a $100 Amazon gift card. The URL is podsurvey.com/capspace. That's podsurvey.com/capspace. Usually between 2 and 8% of listeners respond to these surveys. We've blown way past 2%. We're almost at 8% now. This is the last time I'm going to run this, but it'd be a huge favor to us if we can really get up to 10%. That would be absolutely fantastic. If you haven't done it yet, this is probably the biggest thing that you can do to help support the pod. And, you know, if we get advertisers, I promise not to totally inundate you. We'll do just two ads during the body of the show, one pre-roll ad, and, you know, it'll be enough to make a decent living and not go crazy with you guys. I think that's fair considering that TV and radio are like one third ads. So let me give you the URL again, podsurvey.com/capspace. If you go to my Twitter page, the link to it is pinned at the top of my page right now. That's Nate Duncan NBA. So thanks so much. The response has been great so far. And in the next couple of days, if we can get a few hundred more even, that would be fantastic for us. Makes the show look really good. Podsurvey.com/capspace. Thank you so much for all your support.
All right, let's go to the second game of the day, which we were present for. Just an absolute shellacking. I mean, the biggest news by far out of this is Steph Curry's ankle injury. We can we'll save some talk on that until the end. We picked this in five, but figured that it would probably be pretty ugly for Houston most of the way through. I see absolutely no reason to believe that will not be the case. I mean, probably the most surprising thing of this game to me was just that Houston could not score to save their lives.
Yeah, and there are a lot of different ways that they couldn't score, but the one that's getting attention, I believe there's a lot of credence to it, is that James Harden did not attempt a free throw, which is incredible given his insane gift for drawing fouls.
Yeah, the Warriors did a great job of not fouling him. There's a good quote from Marcus Thompson's story that basically their plan is to keep your arms out wide and not bring him forward when you're playing Harden, because what he likes to do is when he starts driving to the basket, if he sees that he's kind of side by side with someone, if he sees that your arms are out, he will then just take his, or, you know, or kind of reaching, he will just then take those arms up through your arm and draw a foul. And they did a pretty good job of that towards the end of the playoffs last year too, when he had just that miserable game. He was like 3 out of 15 with 12 turnovers or something. It was like close to the most turnovers in playoff history, as I recall. So they're trying to just move their feet, move their chest to get in front of Harden. And Harden doesn't have a crap ton of quickness anymore. You know, the decline in sort of his body composition over the last few years, he's not blowing by people the way that maybe he did a couple of years ago, even though I think he's only 26. So that was great. And here's what Steve Kerr had to say about being able to keep them off the foul line.
Pretty amazing to think that James Harden went a playoff game without shooting a free throw. And how proud of you of that stat are you?
Yeah, that was important. You know, that's what he does better than anybody in the league. You know, get to the line, draw fouls. So I thought Clay did a great job. Andre did a great job. Our bigs stayed vertical. You know, they didn't reach when he came in into the paint. And he got going in the second half, but we kept him off the line, which was very important.
Yeah, it really has been a constant refrain for Golden State, and that is why, you know, they are such a good defensive team. I have a question for you. Do you think, despite the fact that the Spurs had a much better statistical defensive performance this year, that the Warriors are actually still the best defensive team in the league?
I think they have the highest ceiling, which is probably the most relevant when we're talking about this. But I think the Spurs generally operate at a higher level. So I have a personal preference for what the Warriors do, but the Spurs have those singular talents. Like, I think the Spurs, let's say, defend the Thunder better. But on the aggregate, I would probably rather have the Warriors defend.
Yeah, I think other than the Thunder, that's a great point. I would say I would rather have the Warriors, at least in the playoffs, because and the Warriors have a lot more weak links. You know, their bench, you know, guys like Spates or even Varejao, Ian Clark, like those guys aren't good defense players, and that can kind of show it in garbage time. That's probably a big reason, too, why the Spurs looked a little bit better. But to me, there are things you can attack in the Spurs defense, right? You could put Tim Duncan in pick and roll. You know, there are ways. David West is not that quick. Even LaMarcus is not that quick. Like, those guys do a great job with positioning, but they don't necessarily have the physical gifts. Whereas the Warriors, you know, maybe you can say the way you could attack them is try to, like, run a pick and roll involving Steph and then go right at Steph, you know, one-on-one. I mean, that's and that now you're kind of breaking away from what the game plan is for most offenses, and Steph is not really much of a pushover there. I mean, he had a couple of bad games this year, like that Bucks game, but overall, I mean, unless you're KD, who can just score one-on-one on just about anyone on the Warriors, you know, there's not really much else that you can do. I mean, even LeBron, you know, was not able to really score one-on-one against the Warriors when they go with their best guys.
Something that should be scary to the rest of the league with this game was that the Warriors annihilated the Rockets, and I would argue that Klay Thompson and Harrison Barnes did not play particularly well. And to be able to just demolish a team as inconsistent but as good as the Rockets are when two of your four or five best players just don't have it is awfully impressive.
Yeah, and that was the case because of the defense for the Warriors. 104-78 was the final. It was 60-33 at halftime, 33-15 after one, and it was a high possession game too. I mean, they scored 33 points in the first. I think they had a 65 offensive efficiency in the first half, which was absolutely miserable. The other thing too is the Rocks had no answer whatsoever for Curry. Curry had 24 points on 13 shooting possessions in the first half, which is basically a made two-pointer every time you're shooting it. That efficiency, and really nobody else on the Warriors had a great offensive game. Maybe you could look at Spates as potentially the only other guy.
Azealia in a way, but that's a very limited, that's not a creation role, that's a, you know, capitalization role.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And for Houston, I mean, another huge problem for them was just not being able to score at the rim. They tried going small to start Corey Brewer essentially at the four, but that doesn't really help that much. It helps a little bit on defense, but they weren't actually switching everything on defense, and they don't really have the level of communication needed to do that anyway. And Dwight Howard has declined to the point where when it used to be, even last year, you know, he could get out on stuff and, like, be one of the better guys switching. He is just not that guy anymore. Every time his man would set some sort of a pin down, he was just nailed to the paint, and, you know, Clay or Steph would just get wide open looks, and Howard is just like, you know, hey, you know, do your job, you know, one of these type of things. Like, if they're going to really stop these guys, Howard has to be more engaged to where he can actually, like, get out on shooters. Capella does a little better job of that, but he's, like, not really smart enough to, you know, make all the adjustments and the communication factor. Yeah, I mean, there's no aspect of the game in which the Rockets look good. Maybe the only one that you could point to was in the third quarter. Once Steph went out, they had one adjustment, and Bickerstaff was asked about, like, that period, you know, what they could take away from that. And here's what he had to say.
JB, what did you guys get differently in the third? I mean, James scored a little bit. And we pushed him more. We ran more. You know, we went with the lineup where he was handling the ball. You know, as the point guard in that situation, the pick and roll was good. You know, we had four small spaced around him. He was able to get downhill. We set screens higher on the floor for him, and he opened up driving lanes where it was a one-on-one versus him and the bigs.
Yeah, and that's, you know, they did have some success with that, but unfortunately you can't get out and run every time when you're taking the ball out of the basket. The more you run, kind of the more you're going to get into just a transition game. And that's what the Rockets play. You know, it's not like you can't just change the identity of your team and play slow overnight. And if they do, then it's going to be Harden ISO right into the teeth of the defense where, you know, Golden State's rim protection was awesome. They were five out of 14 at the rim in the first quarter or in the first half. So Bogut was great. Azealia was great. Azealia's rebounding was just fantastic in this game on both ends.
Well, and another problem with that, Bickerstaff staff talked about how, you know, you want to have shooters around Harden and you want to have shooters around the pick and roll, which, of course, we agree with. That's what you want to do. But
yeah, who are those?
Yeah,
exactly?
they don't have those guys. Like, yeah, sure, it's great. And that's part of the reason why 3-and-D guys, let's say, are so valuable, because you have to stay out on them. You don't have to stay out on Corey Brewer in that same way. So that diminishes the amount of space that James Harden has to drive in. And when the team is playing him, you know, not to foul and to basically kind of extend the possession that way, then those guys can come over and help. And the Rockets don't really have a counter to that. And the other point, we talked about this a little bit, but I think is very important in this series, is that the Rockets have some strong individual defenders. I think Beverly, you know, he did a pretty good job on Curry when he was out there, though he got in foul trouble. Ariza is a talented team defender, though he doesn't really have a guy in this series. And Howard has his moments. I like him at the rim still. The rest of the guys on their team, for the most part, are bad defenders. It's not just that they're average or something like that. They're almost all bad. And so you have to deal with that. And a moment that I talked about, it was at the end of the second quarter, they had Jason Terry, they had Harden, I think, and they had two, Beasley and Josh Smith were all on the floor together. And so you're sitting there and you're like, okay, you know, that team's going to give us some points. But Stephen Curry was still on the floor and he was getting functionally unlimited good looks. And you can put those lineups out there in certain circumstances, but you cannot do it when a player like Stephen Curry, who will take advantage of that, is there.
Curry went absolutely crazy in the minutes he was out there and not guarded by Patrick Beverly. Biggerstaff took Beverly out towards the end of the first. I don't know why, if you're going to have Beverly on the floor, you're not going to just match him up with every single Steph minute. And then, you know, one reason for that, I guess, could be foul trouble and just the energy that it takes. So Beverly got in foul trouble at the end of the second quarter, and Steph also went off during that period. But, I mean, you got to try and match those guys up as much as possible. There was a little bit of a scrape between Steph and Patrick Beverly. We won't spend too much time on it. The only thing that I have, I'm sure you saw it on SportsCenter or whatever, the only thing that I have to add is I didn't think that it actually was a foul initially on Beverly. I thought he was just kind of chesting up. You know, he wasn't using his hands. And then, you know, he kind of instigated things a little bit after the play, after he got called for a foul. And just in general, Houston had a really rough whistle in this game. I thought Golden State was getting a lot of easy foul calls. And then, you know, Houston getting to the rim did not get their foul calls. You know, it wouldn't have mattered. The Golden State killed them. But it was something to note.
I also want to note that the crowd was really amped up for this game. It was on the short list of the most amped up, and part of that was also just by the way that the game started. No, not the very beginning when neither team could score a basket, but a little bit after that when Curry started going off and then the double technicals.
The double technicals with Beverly. So Curry did hurt his ankle. It was a little concerning. He tried to, it was at the end of the first half on a play where he actually, one of the few kind of selfish plays that we've seen him make, where he kind of tried, he was really on fire and he tried to fake out three guys and shoot a floater just to get like a Vine highlight when he had Draymond wide open for three at the top of the key. But, you know, whatever, he's earned the right to do that. And I couldn't even see exactly where it happened. You didn't see much of a turn. The cameras did not have a great angle on it. It was just the overhead camera. But it was a little concerning in that it was reminiscent of the days back in 2012-13 when he would just tweak his ankle without even any contact, you know, and you worried that, like, he didn't have the proprioception to, like, avoid hurting himself. I mean, I think he'll probably be fine. You know, he tried to come back in. It was clear he was limping around. Coach Kerr made a great call to take him out and said that even if it had been a close game, he would not have brought Steph back in. That also would have been the right call. They're massive favorites in this series. Even if they were down, you know, 2-1, I would expect them to be fine when Steph came back. But Kerr also had a few other interesting things to say about the Steph injury. Here's what it was.
I think, Steve, now by now it's obvious you should never have gone for 73 wins. Was your team just dead tired in this game?
This is probably why Steph rolled his ankle, because we went for 73. My mistake.
So I would not go quite as far as Kerr is to say, oh, the rest thing had absolutely nothing to do with this. Like, we just don't know whether that's the case or not.
Yeah, I think that it's always hard kind of to know in these kind of circumstances, but I lean that way as well.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, and this is all speculation, right? Like, it could be that, hey, when Steph plays minute number 3,000 or whatever it is, he gets too tired and, you know, this becomes, like, much more likely to happen. Or, you know, if he had skipped a couple of games, he would have been rested, and then, you know, maybe he wouldn't have been in that situation or something. You know, that's sort of an injury. I mean, if you come down on someone's foot, that to me is a lot more okay. It's just the vagaries of fate type of thing. But to just kind of do it when you're out in the open like that and just kind of you're not, your body just doesn't position itself properly, maybe that actually could have something to do with fatigue. I don't know for sure, but I wouldn't have dismissed the possibility as quickly necessarily as Kerr did there.
One of our recent advertisers that we've been getting a great response to is Indochino. Indochino is custom menswear. Made-to-measure suits, thanks to Indochino, are now affordable. I always wanted one. I'm kind of an oddly proportioned guy. Off the rack never really worked for me, and getting something done custom was thousands of dollars. That's no longer the case. If you use the CapSpace code at checkout, you can get any premium suit for just $3.99 at Indochino.com. A lot of our international listeners have wondered how to support the podcast when some of the sponsors don't ship internationally. Indochino does. They will FedEx it. No matter where you are, shipping is free, and you can get an awesome made-to-measure suit. I wore it actually to the game against the Warriors, got some nice compliments on it. My girlfriend loves it. It's a beautiful, like, shark skin gray. I didn't have a suit like that. Fits better than any of my other suits, even the ones I've had tailored at the department store. Those ones just do not measure up. So get any premium suit, just $3.99, up to 50% off at Indochino.com. Use that CapSpace code. That's the CapSpace code. Everybody remembers that because we talk about CapSpace all the time on the show. Indochino, your look, your way.
All right, Boston and Atlanta. This was the best game of the day on Saturday, but sadly was marred by what could end up being the death knell for the Celtics in this series, and that is the fact that Avery Bradley is looking like he's going to be out for the entire series per Brad Stevens with a hamstring injury.
Yeah, there were a series of different reports about, you know, the severity of the injury, and exactly none of it looked good.
Yeah, it was seemed fairly innocuous that he just was kind of starting to run up court, and I think he was a little bit behind the play after he had defended a missed layup, and I think he was just trying to shift it into gear and run down and fill a lane on the fast break and just blew a tire. And he, you know, it's rare that you will see guys in that much pain with a hamstring injury. He was down on the ground and then apparently had to be helped to put his shoes on. And basically, like, meaning he couldn't even bend over far enough to do that. So you have to imagine that is correct, that he will be out for the remainder of the series. And that's really going to kill Boston because their effective lineups in the second half were ones that really involved only one big. They started one big in the second half, and now they just aren't going to, and they also just struggle to shoot the ball, so they just aren't going to have enough quality smalls to avoid playing some of those bigs against an Atlanta team that has more versatile bigs, guys like, of course, Paul Millsap.
Yeah, Millsap and Horford, I thought, both played very well. And the way the analogy might be to Oklahoma City's problem more generally, which is just not having those guys to be able to play Durant at the four. With Boston, they have more players, they're just not playing.
Yeah, and another problem for Boston, too, is that even at the five, Jared Sullinger is their best offensive option at the five, but he can't really guard Al Horford. Al Horford sprinted past him in transition quite a few times. He also, in pick and pop, even out to the three-point line, can be a real problem. And Al was wonderful. He had 24 points on 21 shooting possessions and 5 offensive rebounds. That was another huge problem for Boston, is that the Hawks, I think, set a league record for worst offensive rebounding percentage since it's been tracked. And to still give up that many offensive rebounds was a disappointment as well, especially during the part of the game when Atlanta was dominating.
Yeah, and one of the other facets of their domination in the early part, I thought Kent Bazemore did a really good job considering Brad Stevens made the prudent decision to put Isaiah Thomas on him.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Bradley was guarding Teague, and actually, before Bradley went out, he was strangely ineffective on Teague as well. I mean, I thought really everyone for Atlanta, other than Kyle Korver, who was 1-10 and 0-7 on threes, and Schroeder, who only ended up playing 11 minutes, played pretty well. I guess Hardaway, too, was another guy off the bench who didn't get much time. But yeah, you know, I thought that Bazemore and Teague were both able to really get going. And now you kind of have the same question, right? Are you going to put Isaiah Thomas on Bazemore, where Bazemore, at the very least, can shoot over the top when he's spotted up on the weak side? Isaiah's going to really struggle to close out on him. Or are you going to go with Thomas on Teague. Presumably Marcus Smart or Evan Turner will be the other starter now. And so one of those guys, you know, do you put him on Teague? Do you put him on Bazemore?
Yeah, it's a big challenge. And also, you know, as they're thinning out their rotation, you run into the challenge of how do you want to use Marcus Smart, because he's their best guard defender now. And he's also their best second point guard. So will they give Terry Rozier some minutes or reshuffle it in a couple of other ways to make it work?
I started saying that the Celtics were in a little bit of a quandary at center. I mean, they started Johnson and Sullinger together. That's not a great matchup because Sullinger is going to struggle to guard either Horford or Millsap. And then with Amir Johnson, he can set some decent screens, and he was wonderful in this game in pick-and-roll defense. But he also is basically just a turnover machine, it seems like, whenever he is handling the ball up top and, you know, is not going to make great passes, doesn't have the best hands trying to finish as well. So that's another issue. It's really, you know, the Celtics are kind of, they have all this depth of guys who are good NBA players. But now, especially with Bradley out, he was really one of the only guys other than Crowder that you look at as like a full two-way guy on this team. And so it makes things a lot harder, and Brad Stevens now is going to have some hard choices.
And another big story from this game, what probably would have been the biggest one before Bradley got hurt, is the incredible dichotomy between the first and second half for Boston. And there might be no better stat for it than fast break points, because Boston had zero fast break points in the first half, then 11 in the third quarter and 4 in the fourth.
Yeah, that was one aspect. They shot 23% from the field in the first half. They were only 4-for-19 in the paint and 2-of-16 from three. John Barry got some flack on Twitter because he was saying, oh, you got to stop shooting threes, got to get into the paint. Well, yeah, they were missing all their shots in the paint because Atlanta wasn't guarding their shooters. So you have to just keep taking those good shots. I mean, Brad Stevens even said it at the interview at the end of the first quarter that he thought they were getting good shots, and those did start to fall. 14 of 20 in the paint in the second half and 9 of 19 from three, and a lot of that was helped too by actually getting some stops, getting out on the fast break, as you mentioned. Yeah, I mean, what else stuck out to you about the second half? I mean, I thought also starting Turner instead of, I think it was Amir Johnson alongside Sullinger, and then they started switching nearly everything too. And that to me was the other one, that the strategy that's kind of always been the winning strategy, I think, against the Hawks. But they were able to score just enough to beat that, and Teague was probably the main guy with that. He was able to get into the lane, beat the switch, and then score at the rim.
Yeah, and I also thought it was interesting when the other way, when the Hawks were switching and Millsap was guarding Isaiah Thomas, I thought he did a pretty good job.
Yeah, Millsap is going to do a pretty decent job there. I think that really when the Celtics do switch, they should back off on Teague and make him shoot that three-pointer off the dribble. He has shot very well on catch-and-shoot three-pointers, but not quite as well off the dribble, and didn't really in last year's playoffs either. And so that's one aspect of what I thought stood out for me. One thing that I think is a little bit more micro, but that the Celtics are really going to regret, is even in that wonderful third quarter, they got into the bonus with about 10 minutes left in the quarter, and that cost them 6 free throws, plays that where they fouled out on the floor, non-shooting fouls that became free throws. Bazemore got 2, and then there was an over-the-back breaker from Amir Johnson as well, and those will really kill you because their base defense was doing so well during that period. So you have kind of a lower expectation when you're defending for just a normal possession and then bailing them out with a foul. Now, you can argue that part of that fouling, they're reaching in a lot, was what let them get those steals and get those fast breaks too. So it's a double-edged sword. But they will definitely look back on that with some of those dumb fouls, no chance reach-ins that really may have cost them this one.
And it kind of doubles in effect as well, because you're guaranteeing that the other team is going to get to be in their set half-court defense, and Boston was doing a lot better in transition than they were in the half-court. So you basically set up both those things at the same time and give them a guaranteed shot at point.
For Atlanta, they did not play Chris Humphries at all, who's kind of been playing as their backup center. They played basically three bigs all of the minutes. And Mike Scott was fantastic for them. He was 6 out of 9, 2 of 4 on threes, 14 points, and +7. And actually had 3 offensive rebounds as well. You should not be giving up offensive rebounds to Mike Scott. And Scott actually was coming off a broken foot last year. Kale Schwinard, who was a Hawks writer for their team site, tweeted me that he also was struggling with, you know, having taken a hard fall on his tailbone last year, and he was terrible in the playoffs last year. When he really has it going off the bench, they become so much harder to guard, and that really takes away from, as well, any chance that Boston can have to go with two traditional bigs. Boston needs to get more out of guys like Jerebko, who was 0-for-3 on threes. Kelly Olynyk only played 12 minutes in this game. He's going to have to be a bigger part of this series if they're going to score. And he was part of those bench units that really got hurt as well. You thought that he might have an advantage against someone like Scott, and instead it was the opposite last game.
What did you think of Marcus Smart in this game? I thought there were some nice flashes for him. Of course, you still have the problem with his incredibly inconsistent jump shot.
Yeah, he shot 25% on threes this year, and you know, I tweeted that he just doesn't make enough shots, and that's a big problem with him. He actually ended up going 3-of-6 on threes. They also ran like a play for him late for a three, which I thought was a little ambitious, putting his previous 5 shots in this game over what he's been able to do all year. Is like, that's the guy we're going to go to for a late game three. But you know, it was, I thought he was great defensively. He competes, he draws BS fouls by really getting physical and then all of a sudden not being physical and flopping. That kind of throws guys off as well. So I thought he was good. I mean, but he's just going to have to be better offensively. He's going to have to hit his threes. I think otherwise, the Celtics are really going to struggle to score against this Atlanta defense, which will give up threes because they're trapping the ball handler on pick and roll, getting the ball out of the hands of someone like Isaiah Thomas, and that's going to lead to some open threes as they have to help then on whoever the role man is. But, you know, I don't think that the Celtics have enough guys to take advantage of that threat, and they really may need to play Olynyk more now without Bradley in there just to get enough shooting. But can Olynyk hold up as the lone big defensively, especially if he's going against starters? He's probably okay against some backup units, but I don't know about against starters.
Another potential outlet, not for the center position, but at the four, is Jerebko, who struggled a lot in this game. He ended up 1-of-6 from the field, 0-of-3 from 3. If he can hit a couple of those shots, in a way paralleling like a kind of a poor man's Mike Scott in that way, it adds another dimension to some second units.
Yeah, and Jerebko is a guy who can switch, who can defend. I mean, I think the Celtics did find something. They generally have not been a team that has been willing to switch. We talked about that in the preview, but especially now with Bradley out, the fact that Smart has the strength that he does, I think that that's a strategy they're just going to need to go to more and more often. The problem is, you know, can Sullinger, who they probably also are going to need now to score, can he hold up in that? And then if you go with Johnson, who's good at it, then maybe you're going to struggle to score again. So it's not looking good for Boston. They had an heroic comeback, to be sure. Wasn't quite as close as the final score indicated. They hit a garbage three. They went for a pretty miserable quick two as well. Did you have anything else on this one?
No, I mean, it's disappointing because Boston did have that nice second half, and it looks like that'll probably be the big picture highlight of the series, though absolutely they can win a couple games. It's not like they're going to – I don't think they're going to get swept, but that's a little bit of a shame. But the Hawks also, I was impressed with how well they played in this game on the aggregate.
Yeah, at least certainly in the first half. I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I think that part of the – certainly Korver can be expected to shoot better. But in the aggregate, I mean, I was impressed with how well they played too, but I'm not sure. And I guess they were only 5 out of 27 from three somehow. But yeah, maybe I'm not being fair there. I thought Teague played over his head for sure, but then you had, and Bazemore did, but then you had some other guys who weren't as good. I did think that their defense was not that great. They gave up a lot of open threes. 35 3-point attempts is too many, and they kind of got a little lucky that Boston didn't hit him. And then Boston finally, especially in the second half, got on the offensive glass, 15 offensive rebounds for Boston. That's something that the Hawks, one of the worst defensive rebounding teams, also going to have to clean up just a little bit. So when I began working in basketball, I started my own blog, and I realized that this is now, I'm basically a small business owner. And so I got some business cards. Vistaprint is the best way to do that. They have a special ad right now, 500 business cards for just $9.99 when you enter my Capspace promo code at checkout. And not only do they have business cards, they offer a ton of other custom products for home and office needs, whether it's postcards, flyers, banners, mugs, t-shirts, whatever you need printed. Basically, Vistaprint is your local print shop. They offer that level of service, but because they're a lot bigger and do their work over the internet, they have less overhead and much greater economies of scale, so their prices are much cheaper. If you want to personalize your business cards, easy way to do that at Vistaprint. Colors, backsides, tests, they have thousands of industry-specific templates. You can upload your logo and they'll print it out for you. You can upgrade to a thicker stock or add some sort of a brilliant finish. It's very easy to use and user-friendly. They guarantee that you'll love your products, or they'll make it right if they send it to you and it's not what you wanted. So go to Vistaprint.com, 500 business cards starting at $9.99 using the code CAPSPACE at checkout, up to 50% savings over the regular site pricing.
Ready to move on to the last game of the night, the Dallas OKC Slaughter?
Yeah, this is one of those ones where we, you know, we talked about this. I picked this to be a sweep, and I feel great about that. This is just a horrible matchup for Dallas. Their health has not been good. J.J. Barea now apparently is not going to play in Game 2 after, again, re-aggravating his groin. We said that that could be an issue coming in, that those are very easy to re-injure. That's exactly what happened. David Lee is doubtful. Darren Williams now is doubtful as well with that sports hernia that he's been continuing to deal with. 108-70 was the final score, and basically the strategy from the Thunder was that they were going to let Dirk beat them and not let the other guys get off, and Dirk was 7-15, had 18 points, but you know there's only so bad you're going to get hurt by just a bunch of long two-pointers. Dirk was not allowed to shoot a three, and so if he's going to shoot 7-15 on long twos, fine, you deal with that as long as you're not giving up layups to everybody else.
Well, of course it's biased a little bit because the starters didn't play that much. Dirk had 18 points, and the rest of their starters combined for 12.
That's bad. And really, yeah, their whole team, they shot 30% from the field overall, 4 of 18 from 3, 18 three-point attempts. That's nowhere near enough for them to be efficient. Oklahoma City, on the other hand, got up 35 three-point attempts against Dallas. They tried to start Salah Mejri. That didn't go incredibly well, you know, to get some more rim protection. Kevin Durant actually, like, went right through him at the rim a couple of times early. Just Mejri is not that strong, you know, especially if KD, you know, a relatively skinny guy, is able to just go right through you at the rim. Another thing, too, is that Barea was guarding Andre Roberson. And so usually you can just help off of Roberson a ton, but Barea is so short, he's not really going to be effective in that role, just not guarding someone. So that didn't help that much. I mean, I think that, we forgot to also say that Oklahoma City rebounded over 40% of their misses during the relevant portion of this game as well. That was another thing that we thought would be a real problem for Dallas going in this matchup. Serge Ibaka was fantastic, 7 of 8 from the field, 17 points, 3 block shots, and did pretty well on Dirk. Dirk's not going to be able to score one-on-one in the post against him at this point in their careers. The only Thunder who really didn't play that well was Deion Waiters, who was 1 out of 9.
Yeah, I forgot to mention, Dallas' starters, they had the non-Dirk starters had 12 points, yes, but they were a 5 of 25 shooting, which is almost, it seems like it's almost impossible.
Yeah, that first quarter was just one of the bigger displays of ineptitude from a team in the first quarter of a playoff game. 11 points for Dallas, 5 of 24 from the field, 1 of 5 from the line on 24 possessions, and OKC started the game out 15-2. It was just never close at all.
If you're Billy Donovan, do you start maneuvering your rotations in the first quarter, basically assuming that the game's not going to be close late, and you know, just cut shorter rotations for Durant and Westbrook because you're not going to need it?
No, it's the playoffs. They're going to have, and especially you're better off from a rest standpoint, just making sure you win the series in 4 games, then you can rest as much as you want. What do you see in terms of adjustments for Dallas after this 38-point shellacking?
Well, the big problem is, so their point guards are dropping like flies, which, I mean, due to injuries that already existed, but they don't have any wing depth. I mean, this was already an issue. Justin Anderson got kind of thrust into a role, though he didn't start despite starting in their nice stretch at the end of the season, but they just don't have other guys, so I don't really know what they can do.
Yeah, I thought, especially with Barea's injury issues, starting him was not a great idea, especially when you consider that there really is not a great hiding place for him with the athleticism that the Thunder have in their starting lineup. The fact that you're going to need someone who can help off of Roberson as well. Justin Anderson, you know, they had that 6-game winning streak. He started, he only played 6 minutes through the third quarter. Rick Carlisle, his quote on that was that we were playing veterans. We played veterans predominantly in the Utah game, which is the biggest game of the year, and that Anderson obviously has got to be more involved going forward, if only because they only have a certain number of healthy bodies available. So Rick said, quote, he'll be a big part of it, no question about it. And he'll also help with the rebounding, too. He had an awesome defensive rebound this year for a small forward, 19%. So that's another reason why getting him in there can really help them. It's not going to make a difference. I think they're going to get swept. And I saw nothing in game one to change that opinion, that's for sure.
Yeah, my thought when I picked it to go five was basically that Carlisle, and you know they'd have one hot stretch, but I don't even know that they have enough guys left to do that. Like, this isn't a situation where you have Lillard and McCollum who they could go off together and do it. It's really hard to imagine Dallas winning a game.
Yeah, Wes Matthews looked totally overmatched guarding KD, who had 23 points in 27 minutes. Matthews was negative 40 on the game in 29 minutes. He is too short for Durant, doesn't have the athleticism to really challenge his shots, not quite strong enough or quick enough either to get into his body. And that's the best they got. I mean, to me, you know, and there are a couple of series that are like this. We didn't say this about Golden State, but I think the Golden State Rockets series, but if I'm the Rockets, you're not winning the series. I might just try to see what I have in Capella and KJ McDaniels a little more, just to see how that might affect my off-season planning on an idea on what we need. And for Justin Anderson, I think it might be kind of the same for Dallas as well. I mean, Ray Felton, another one of these little point guards that doesn't really play with much force. He was 2 out of 10. And I loved the strategy from Donovan. People were talking about how Donovan was going to get out coached in the series, and that might still happen, but it sure as hell didn't happen in game one.
Yeah, I actually agree more strongly with Justin Anderson with that logic, because the Mavericks really aren't winning that series. And while Houston, it probably isn't, the Stephen Curry injury opens the door just the teensiest little bit. But at this, what that brings you, because of course Oklahoma City is still going to play their starters, is you get a little window into not only how they play in the playoffs, but how they play in the playoffs in a role that you might want to see them in long term. So Clint Capella, if you play him against the Warriors starters, that's a pretty good barometer of what you're going to do. And some of those guys are under contract, Anderson, Capella. But also, you want to have an idea of what you have in terms of making offers for other guys. I think Dwight Powell's another guy like that. You give Powell some minutes just to see how he works, and there's no real harm there. You're not costing yourself a win.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. You know, it's hard to sell that, the idea, especially when you have proud veterans in a locker room the way you do with Dallas. Some of them proud veterans who can be free agents as well. But yeah, I mean, if D-Will's not going to play, Bure's not going to play, Lee's not going to play. And that's one of the downsides of kind of signing all these old vets. Yeah, they know how to play, but they're also a lot more likely to get injured. And this is the second playoffs in a row now where Dallas has been kind of too injured to compete.
Yeah, it really is a shame. And also the risk for them that I was kind of stunned by when I was looking at the lineup for this game is just how many guys they have that are going to be free agents. I mean, it's incredible. You think about how much turnover this team could have in a couple of months.
The other thing, just in a general team building sense for these guys, and this is another reason why I was galled that Anderson played so little, this team just has no athleticism, like, in the entire team. You know, you go down by position. Darren Williams, he's well past his prime. Wes Matthews coming off an Achilles. And those are two of their more athletic guys. Ray Felton, J.J. Barea, Dirk, obviously. I mean, if you're going to have Dirk as the centerpiece of your team, you damn well better have some athleticism next to him. And that was obviously the thought in chasing after DeAndre Jordan. But I think that Rick, his famous reluctance to play rookies, just in a general sense, they may need to go away from that philosophy and get younger players. Hopefully he can coach them up, because they just got to have some more athleticism out there.
Good thing they have their draft pick. Oh, wait.
Oh, that's a nice way to move on for Mavericks fans.
Yeah.
On to the Sunday games, Cavs and Pistons. This one took on somewhat of a similar tenor to what we had talked about in the preview show, where the Pistons were able to kind of stay in it and then ended up getting beat late.
Yeah, there were a couple of major notes, and I guess we should start with the one that bothered us most during the game, which is the lack of Channing Frye.
Did that bother me the most?
Well, I mean,
I guess
they eventually resolved the Love at Center thing, so that probably would have been there too, but then they did that.
Yeah, I feel like they made up for it by playing Love at Center so much. I liked that. I thought that the Pistons, not a team that has a bunch of guys who are just going to streak to the rim and finish. Drummond was not enough of a factor on the offensive glass to really obviate that strategy from the Cavs. So I liked it. I thought that lineup is one that is really good for them. I think that even is probably one of their best chances against the Warriors, just because it's so difficult to stop. And Kevin Love, partially buoyed by that lineup, partially buoyed by being guarded by the combo forwards on Detroit really got the better of them and probably had, given the stakes, I would say his best game as a Cav.
Yeah, I'd certainly say that's fair. Do you want me to give the stats for the time that Kevin Love played center?
Yes.
So our friend Kevin Pelton put it together. It was 12 and a half minutes. They were plus 8, which translated to a 126.1 per 100 offensive rating and a 90.9 per 100 defensive rating. So that's a massive gap during that stretch. And as you said, like, one of the big reasons why we both supported doing that against Detroit is that, generally speaking, going with a stretch guy at the five, you're having to make a choice. You're sacrificing something. And you certainly are when you have Kevin Love there. But Detroit, despite their front court talent, is not well suited to exploiting that to its maximum effect, whereas some other teams honestly are.
Yeah, and it's not like Cleveland's other guys are great rim protectors either. Thompson's value is more in his ability to switch out, to move his feet out in space necessarily than it is to actually protect the rim. He's not one of the league's best rim protectors either. So when you consider what an offensive upgrade Love is on him, things start to look pretty good. And then Detroit got really stagnant down the end too. They also went with Aaron Baines a little bit in the last 3 minutes instead of Drummond because they were scared of the hacking. Drummond actually only 1 for 2 from the foul line. So the Cavs did not employ that strategy at all. I thought it was an encouraging performance for Detroit in terms of how well they scored, but also really an unsustainable one. I tweeted at halftime when they were up after a great second quarter that they really were getting outplayed by the Cavs, and they just ended up shooting 15 of 29 on threes. Like, you're not going to shoot that well. Again, they're just going to have to defend better. Like, 106 doesn't look that bad to give up until you consider this is a really, really slow game for these two teams. And so, yeah, I don't think Detroit can stop Cleveland at all. And with that being the case, what adjustments do we see that the Pistons might be able to make?
It's tough because Detroit's limitation in many ways is their lack of creators. I mean, Reggie can do some things, but really they don't have too much else. I would like to see more Stanley Johnson and maybe even some Anthony Tolliver, especially in the moments when LeBron's on the floor, because I think we saw that there's two starting forwards can't really defend him that well. So I think that would be one adjustment that they could do. And I think that's probably the primary one, because I thought KCP, for the most part, did a decent job on Kyrie.
Yeah, although Kyrie was 10 out of 24, but he did shoot 5 out of 10 on threes and got to the foul line. So it was a relatively efficient game, but not an absolute killer one. Love was 10 out of 22. Both those guys actually shot a lot more than LeBron did. LeBron was more of a facilitator, had 11 assists on the night. The Pistons, I think, Stanley Johnson, as you mentioned, really impressed in his time on LeBron, I thought. And Harris and Morris, I don't think, have much of a chance on him. And I also think that Johnson is at least the equal as a standstill shooter of Harris, and that Harris is not necessarily, you know, he wasn't able to kind of fulfill his end of the bargain. If he was going to go up against Kevin Love, Love was the one who had the offensive advantage on him, and he wasn't really able to get going back, and LeBron was guarding him a fair amount too. So I say, why not give some more time for Stanley pretty early on, let Harris come in with that second unit, try to be more of a creator with them, especially in lineups where the Cavs are trying to go small with even guys like Richard Jefferson at the four when LeBron is out of the game. And if they do that, then they might have a little better chance of stopping him. And then another guy that I think they should consider unearthing is Anthony Tolliver, probably the one kind of true four that they have on the roster who can guard Love in the post. Again, you know, I've been very clear, I don't think Love is a plus post player against a lot of teams, but these are teams that just have combo forwards. And so Love was able to get deep position on them. He was able to draw fouls. He was able to use his body. And again, it's a great game for him. He still was only 10 out of 22, but then shooting the three so well also was a huge part of his game, and he ended up plus 12 on the night. And as I said, I mean, just hitting his threes also is, you know, when he shoots 50% on threes, which he hasn't really very often in his Cavs career, that kind of unlocks things a lot for him too.
One adjustment I'd make for Cleveland, I tweeted about this a little bit during the game, is that Matthew Dellavedova, I like him more as a defender than an offensive player, though of course he can play off LeBron. And I think he's a perfect fit to be that guy who comes in early and goes against the opposing team's starting point guard because he can get under their skin and defend them. And Lou was mostly using him when Steve Blake was in, and I think you're just losing value of what Dellavedova does well on really on both ends when you do play him that way, when you make him more of a second unit guy.
Yeah, I think that's right, and we should get to Fry. I do think that Fry not playing at all doesn't make a ton of sense. You never know in these situations, but David Griffin provided some resources to get Fry. Part of that, the first round pick that they gave up, was also just to dump Varejao's contract. But nonetheless, he did, and I think that's because he thinks he's good. He had him in Phoenix as well when he was there. But Lou didn't want to play him, and he went with Mozgov a little bit as the backup center in the first half. He did not play at all in the second half. And then, of course, they went to the Love at center really for the last 10 minutes of the game or so. It was, I think, Thompson played the entire time at center before that in the second half. And Fry can give him the same kind of spacing that Love can. I think Fry is a great matchup when Aaron Baines is in the game. I could see why maybe you wouldn't want to go with him against Drummond, but because you're worrying about the physicality and the rebounding. But when Baines is in, you know, a pick and pop between Fry and Kyrie is not something that Detroit's going to be able to guard, because they can't switch Baines onto Kyrie, and Baines is not going to be mobile enough to help out on Kyrie and get out on Fry as well. That would be totally unstoppable. And I think, you know, I'm not saying Fry is like some absolute world beater, but I think there's a place for him to play 15 minutes a game in this series at center.
And also, there aren't that many places on Cleveland for you to truly hide a guy that you don't want to involve in pick and rolls. There are, you know, you can put him on Shump, you can do a couple of things like that, but it's not a clear-cut thing like, let's say, when the Warriors put Bogut on Tony Allen. There isn't really a spot like that against Cleveland.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that Cleveland is relatively well-rounded from an offensive standpoint. Jeff Van Gundy had the idea when Love was at center of maybe putting Drummond on Iman Shumpert, making Iman Shumpert prove that he can beat you. He's been an okay standstill three-point shooter in the past, but he's been so injured for so long now that I would like to actually make him prove. I feel a lot more comfortable with him shooting it from three than I do Love, for example. Let's see, what else did I have here as far as potential adjustments? Reggie Jackson only played 34 minutes. I felt like he could have played, you know, another four, maybe a little less time. For Steve Blake, who was pretty bad in the first half, but had an okay run in the second half, not great. Reggie Bullock, another guy maybe who could get a little bit more time. You know, he shot 3 of 3 in his 9 minutes, 2 of 2 from 3-point range. Maybe just give him a little bit more of a shot as well. But someone who I think could be a little bit better of a defensive player than Harris and Morris. You know, that's the question, really. I mean, do you stick with the offense here, or do you go with more of a defensive lineup and try to slow the Cavs down a little bit? I think I would probably try doing that, but, you know, I'm not sure there's a great option given their personnel limitations.
There isn't. I would actually maybe even lean more towards, like, kind of specialization in that way of using Stanley more when LeBron's in the floor, because you kind of want to mitigate Cleveland's strengths, and, yeah, you don't always want to cater your game to your opponent, but I think Cleveland, with guys like LeBron, they're good enough that you should do that at least a little bit.
Another strategy, which I think partially led to the Pistons getting so many threes in the first half in particular, was Cleveland blitzing pick and rolls involving Drummond. And the thinking behind that is somewhat sound. That is that if you just have your big hang back, you let Reggie Jackson get into the lane, and then it's almost a two-on-one between Drummond and Jackson and whoever the big is, and they don't have a great rim-protecting big, and that even if Jackson shoots and misses, Drummond is right there on the offensive glass. So the thought is we make Reggie Jackson give up the ball. They don't have any other great playmakers. Drummond, when they threw it to him on kind of a short roll at the free throw line, had some real ugly possessions, just not finding shooters, going to ugly floaters. And so I got that, but what ended up happening was the Pistons were able to move it around out of those situations when they didn't throw it directly to Drummond. They'd throw it to someone else instead and then get open threes. I think, though, I would still probably stick with that strategy just on the idea that the Pistons aren't going to shoot 15 out of 29 on threes again in the next game. And they did a great job keeping Detroit off the offensive glass. They only had 5 offensive rebounds in this one. And I think their 3-point shooting is a little streakier than the offensive rebounding is. So I think I would probably stick with that strategy if I were the Cavs until Detroit really shows that they could beat it, especially if you just leave Drummond open on the short roll, like make him prove that he can make a play he hasn't yet.
Yeah, I agree with that. You want to move on to Heat Hornets?
Well, let me see if I have anything else here in the notes. There are a couple of just small plays I thought that killed Detroit. One was a baseline out of bounds with 1.4 seconds remaining in the first quarter. Lou smartly put LeBron back in, set him up at the top of the key. Van Gundy said, hey, they're going to try and get LeBron coming downhill on this. Dellavedova set a screen for LeBron, and Steve Blake didn't move at all, just let LeBron go right to the rim and get a layup. No reason not to switch there. Like, Dellavedova is not going to, like, swing out for, like, a really tough jumper with 1.4 seconds left on the clock. Switch it, help out, do something. That was really a terrible breakdown. Reggie Jackson's technical was one of the more egregious technicals I've ever seen. He took the shot around the left elbow, probably got fouled across the arm. You know, I think there was, and the game was close at that point, about 2 minutes left, missed a jump shot. And then as the Cavaliers are bringing the ball up court, he takes his mouth guard off and almost runs over to the referee who is on the left side of the floor and just starts yelling at him. I mean, it was just so obvious that he was going to get a tee, and you just can't afford that kind of thing in that situation. And then also when they were still trying to get some buckets at the end, Jackson got a switch on to Kevin Love, which is kind of exactly what you want if you're Detroit. And then Aaron Baines runs over to set a pick and roll. Like, why would you set a pick and roll when he's already being guarded by Kevin Love? That's just a big mental mistake. And Reggie Jackson had to wave him away, and that wasted 5 seconds on the shot clock, and Jackson was unable to get a good shot because he didn't have enough time in that situation. So a lot of kind of little small plays like that for Detroit that they'll be looking back on.
Did today's events affect the way that you thought about the series much, or was it pretty much as you expected it to go?
Yeah, I think so. I think despite the fact that that Detroit was in it, I thought that this is actually probably their best shot of the series, given just how well they shot the ball from three. They're not a great three-point shooting team. You know, to have 4 out of 8 from KCP, 2 out of 4 from Reggie Jackson, 3 of 3 from Stanley Johnson, 2 of 2 from Reggie Bullock from three, that's not happening again. And I thought that they kind of blew their chance. And the other thing I really wanted to say, too, is LeBron was plus 18 in this game. And the key stretches, Detroit got out to nice leads against the Cleveland benches when he was out of the game. And then he came in, you know, with maybe 3 minutes gone by in the second and fourth quarter and just immediately restored over, I think, order. I think the Cavs went on like an 8-0 run both of those times. So it shows the power of those superstars, and maybe a little concerning for the Cavs that they didn't do as well when he was off the floor. I mean, I think that they want to have either both Kyrie and Love or at least Fry so that you can do a little bit better when LeBron is off the floor. That's something that the Cavs need to look at.
Yeah, and they're going to have a tougher series in the next round for sure.
Charlotte and Miami, you had the Heat in 7. I had Charlotte in 6 in the series. Your pick looking just slightly more prescient so far. I think the place to start on this one was, well, one, Luol Deng and Hassan Whiteside were unbelievable for the Heat. But then Charlotte's defense, I just could not believe how bad of a defensive game they played, just how utterly hopeless they looked against the Heat, who you don't think of as like some offensive machine necessarily.
Yeah, I love the way that you phrased this in what I considered a kind of an angry rant on Twitter, which was basically that one of the goals of defense is to try to take something or as many things as possible away. And it was hard to figure out what Charlotte's philosophy was because they weren't executing anything.
Yeah, they took away literally nothing from the Heat. They left shooters open. Luol Deng had a bunch of corner threes, which he drained. They were beaten one-on-one very easily. The pick-and-roll ball handler was scoring on them. The pick-and-roll roll man was scoring on them. Hassan Whiteside was getting all sorts of stuff right at the rim, sometimes when there would be a guard over there trying to help, but many times just with nobody there. And then they gave up a million offensive rebounds as well on the rare occasions they actually could force a miss. It was just a debacle defensively for the Hornets. In the first quarter, 41 points on 23 possessions for Miami and 67 points on 44 possessions in the first half for Miami. Charlotte actually scored okay in the first half. They had 50 points on 43 possessions. Like, that should be enough to get it done. And just, I couldn't believe how badly they got torched.
Yeah, and I was just amazed with how, it's not like the scouting report on the guys on Miami is that complicated. They have very good players. They have good players all around the court, but it didn't seem like they were really trying to focus on like Justice Winslow's inability to shoot, or, you know, Wade kind of sometimes settling for jumpers that he shouldn't, instead of letting him get downhill. And considering how well we both think Steve Clifford did as a coach in the regular season, it was just jarring for me.
Yeah, it's worth remembering that Steve is not an experienced playoff coach, however. He just has that sweep in 2014 to his name. That's it as a head coach. So, you know, I think sometimes it takes coaches time to adjust to the reality that the playoffs is different. Your rotations are shorter. If stuff's not working, you don't have time to just, you know, relax. I mean, you know, some things like, all right, a guy who's a good shooter isn't making wide open shots. All right, that you can expect to regress. But if you see something in the film like, all right, 2, 3, 4 possessions, this guy can't guard this guy, I think you got to kind of react faster than you normally would, because there just, you know, it isn't a ton of time, and the playoffs are much more matchup based. Let's see, what Luol Deng, to talk a little bit more about him. 11 of 13 from the field, 4 of 6 on threes, got to the foul line 7 times, 31 points on 13 field goal attempts, plus 26. That's pretty ridiculous. Hassan Whiteside, 9 of 11 as well, 3 of 5 from the foul line, so he had 21 points on 13 shooting possessions. I mean, those two guys right there were just totally unstoppable for Charlotte.
Yeah, I'm sure Miami's really thankful right now that Luol Deng picked up that player option.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I think it's, and Deng turned 31. You know, the line on him was that he'd been burned out. He wasn't any good anymore due to Tom Thibodeau, and I think he's proved, especially this year, that that's not the case at all. He has plenty left.
So put on your coaching hat. Would you adjust Charlotte's big man rotation given what we saw, or would you keep it the same?
Yeah, this was interesting, right? I think their starters are good. I think that Marvin Williams is a good kind of hybrid four to match up with Deng, to match up with Joe Johnson, those guys. I mean, but then they go to Kaminsky, and they always play two bigs off the bench. You don't think of Williams as a big. He's stretchy enough. He's rangy enough. Got enough ability to defend on the perimeter. I don't think of him that way. Kaminsky, however, shoots threes, and that's worthwhile with the spacing he provides against another big from the other team. However, he doesn't really do any of the other big man things. He doesn't protect the rim. He doesn't rebound. There was one time when Luol Deng just ripped a rebound right out of his hands. They both had a chance for, like, Kaminsky, a 7-footer, that you got to at least get that rebound, you know, if you're a big trying to play against some smalls. And, you know, he's not really important enough that the Hornets are going to go to him in the post against someone like Deng. So he's not really, like you talked about, you know, he's not really providing any advantages. The problem for Charlotte is there isn't really an obvious option to play as kind of a combo forward type as a backup to Marvin. Maybe you could talk about moving Batum to the four and playing Jeremy Lamb more. You know, I think that Lamb, although he hasn't played all that well the second half of the season, is a guy who is at least an athletic guy. Like, Charlotte really got out-athleted by the Heat in this game. So, you know, I think Lamb could help a little bit. He can make an open three. They don't necessarily want to expose Batum to playing the four that much, that wear and tear, but I think, you know, playing against someone like Deng is not going to, you know, he's just what would have formerly been a conventional small forward. So I think that's probably where I would go. Kaminsky did not take a shot attempt in 17 minutes and was 0 for 2 from the line, had one rebound. So that shows you just how utterly ineffective he was against that Heat second unit.
You talked about Batum, you know, not wanting to play him against traditional fours, and I completely agree with you. And one of the developments with Chris Bosh missing time, you know, we don't know how long he'll be out, is Miami doesn't really have any that they play. They have Josh McRoberts. He only played 4 minutes in this game. Everybody else outside of Hassan Whiteside and Amari Stoudemire that they played, the most four-ish they would be is a combo forward.
Yeah, that's true. In fairness to Kaminsky, he was actually one of the only Hornets who had a positive plus-minus in this one, although some of that was probably compiled late in the game. Another problem for the Hornets is Kemba Walker has to win his matchup with Goran Dragic. Dragic was not great offensively, but he did have 10 assists, and he also defended Walker pretty well. I thought that Charlotte would be able to take advantage of pick and rolls involving Whiteside and then getting some open jumpers, but a lot of times they weren't able to get a good enough screen on guys like even Dragic, who you don't think of as being that great at that. You know, whoever was guarding the ball handler, they wouldn't get a good enough screen, and then the ball handler's man would still be able to harass him from behind, and they weren't really able to get, you know, good shots out of that.
Friend of the program, Seth Partnow, strongly encouraged me, and he was completely right, to mention that Goran Dragic and Dwayne Wade started the game, set a very physical defensive tone early in the game, and continued that, and that also helped throw Charlotte's perimeter guys off their game.
Yeah, it did. And part of that was just getting through screens, creating the space to get over those. So, yeah, they did a really nice job. Nick Batum was one of the few Hornets who played well in his contract push. He at least was pretty good offensively at 24 points, although he was also negative 33. But the Heat did a nice job to switch Luol Deng onto him instead of Joe Johnson, who can't keep up with him running off of screens. And then they were able to go with Justice Winslow as well. I also thought the Hornets' pick-and-roll defense was miserable, and going along with the theme of not taking anything away, Cody Zeller would come up, but he wasn't trapping, and he wasn't laying back to sort of prevent the pass to the roll man either and meet the ball handler at the rim. He was just sort of getting up to the level of the ball, but still, like, letting the guy turn the corner a little bit and then just throw an alley-oop to Whiteside. You know, so, I mean, they got to pick one strategy, I think, and have him either blitz the pick and roll, which can be effective against sort of less skilled big guys like, you know, or at least less skilled perimeter big guys like Drummond and Whiteside, or just kind of have him lay back. But, you know, this middle ground that they were kind of patrolling with him just wasn't working at all.
Yeah, it's a great point.
Let me see if I got anything else on this one. Justice Winslow really impressed me on defense again. And it's not only his on-ball defense, but he, for a young guy, he executes the scheme so well. There was one play where they were trying to post up Al Jefferson, and Winslow came all the way over from the middle of the lane to actually get into Jefferson's lap, prevent the pass to him until Whiteside could get there, or maybe it was Stoudemire, whoever the defender was. So they couldn't get the ball into Jefferson. And then when the ball got reversed, he sprinted all the way over to the opposite side and was able to close out on a shooter as well. Really just impressive stuff from him. Both that combination of athleticism and intelligence is going to make him really difficult to deal with for a long time. And then Charlotte, only 17 threes. That's nowhere near enough for them, for Miami to actually take more threes and make 9 out of 18, which they're not going to do again, probably that percentage. You know, that's not good enough for them either. And I thought that Miami did a great job of just kind of funneling everything in to Whiteside, who's a pretty big factor. We saw almost exclusively good Whiteside in this game.
Yeah, I was impressed with him, even though they didn't make him work as hard as I would have expected before this game started.
Yeah, I gave some slight thought, and then I hate myself for it, of saying that maybe they should even try to match up Spencer Hawes against Whiteside just a little bit, see if Hawes can get some three-point shooting going. I mean, Hawes is the guy who can shoot it, not at a great percentage, but maybe you could get hot. But that's kind of more of a desperation, like Game 3 when you're down 2-0 and got blown out in the first two games already. I think Charlotte just makes some small tweaks, maybe get Kaminsky less minutes, Lamb more minutes, and kind of see where you're at after that. So now let's not talk about Spurs-Grizz. How do you feel about that?
I think you have a game in mind.
Yeah. Someone tweeted this today. I think it might have been Seth, or maybe one of Seth's followers that he retweeted, actually, that how many teams in the NBA could the Grizz actually defeat in a seven-game series? They lost 106-74 in this one, in a game that I frankly did not watch. I said I would go back and watch it if it was close, but there's just nothing to be learned from this. The Grizzlies just aren't good enough.
So I have a number. Do you have a number?
Well, let's go through it.
Okay.
We can start at the bottom of the lottery. Philly?
Yes.
The Lakers?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that might actually be a little bit of a dogfight. Brooklyn, I think they could take Brooklyn. The Brooklyn team that finished the season, I think that actually Brooklyn with Thad Young and with Brook Lopez playing might be a tough order.
Yeah, I think I would pick that Brooklyn team, but I'm treating it with the end of the season.
Phoenix, they actually lost twice too, so you might not even be able to say Phoenix, frankly, if Phoenix were really trying. So yeah, I mean, there's probably, you know, I think they're about the same level of team, but Phoenix having beaten them twice at the end of the regular season makes you kind of wonder about that. And that's about it.
Oh, I would add New Orleans to that.
Oh, yeah, I guess that New Orleans team at the end of the year was pretty incredibly bad. That's a good point. Yeah, they could probably take New Orleans.
So that I counted it as 5.
Yeah, I think that might be only 4 for me. So that's, I mean, this might be, I can't think of a worse playoff team than this one as they stand right now that I can recall.
And as we kind of said as various times, that's why I think they should have a different playoff structure, because it's weird to give the number 2 seed this advantage.
Yeah, as opposed, you're talking about being able to pick your opponent, which is something we've talked
yes.
about a fair amount. All right, that was fun. Sorry, Grizz and Spurs fans. We'll see y'all in the next round against Oklahoma City, though. I promise we'll give you some really deep breakdowns of that series. Blazers and Clippers. I will confine the analysis mostly the competitive portion of the game here. What were your kind of initial takeaways on this one, though?
I thought Chris Paul did a very nice job on Damian Lillard, and DeAndre Jordan has just been great in the last recent time, and I think he's going to play a massive role in this series.
Yeah, the problem with DJ is that he's not always consistent, but in this one, he was absolutely fantastic. The Blazers shot, during the relevant portion of the game, up to basically 3 minutes gone by in the fourth quarter, they were 17 out of 38 in the paint. DJ had a ton to do with that. In the first half, Plumlee was 1 out of 6, all very close shots to the rim, just was not able to get anything going on DJ at all. DJ was a monster getting out, trapping the pick and roll against Lillard, which he had no answer for. And when he did have an answer for it, he got it to guys who weren't able to do anything with it. And DJ was able to, you know, after he would set that trap, was able to get into the play. Again, really, I thought he was the MVP for them. Chris Paul destroyed Dame Lillard defensively. I think that the Blazers are going to have to find a place to hide Dame, you know, especially with the starters, you hide him against Mbah Mute. Even, you know, when it's Crawford, when it's Austin Rivers in the game, I mean, none of those threes really for the Clippers kind of scare me. If they want to go to a post up for one of those guys against Dame, you know, given the other options they have, be my guess. And then lastly, I thought that Blake Griffin looked fantastic. We talked about whether he would have the advantage against Portland going small. He absolutely did against guys like Aminu, Harkless. Whenever he got a switch, he was able to bully to the rim. He dunked on Plumlee 3 times for and ones, and then Aminu just wasn't able to hit his shots. You know, I believed in his shooting over the second half of the year, and he certainly, although I appreciated that he was willing to still take them, and he needs to take them the rest of the series to trust the work that he's put in, the numbers don't lie today. He was totally ineffective, 3 out of 12 on largely open shots.
Aminu and Harkless combined 2 of 11 from 3, and that should be better. I mean, it's not going to be a whole heck of a lot better, but even if that gets to 4 or 5, probably 4, that's okay, and you can't knock a team for taking that. It's kind of like what we discussed with the Celtics, you know. At a certain point, you have to be willing to take the shots that should go in, and if they miss, they miss. But, so, like, I mean, this was technically the closest of the Western Conference Game 1s, but I think that Portland they have more room to grow, they have more space to improve than some of these other ones. The problem for them is that they don't really have bigger, like, kind of big solutions, you know, big things that they can do. One that I've advocated for, basically, when any team plays against the Clippers, is that Doc is very rigid in his rotations. He even played 11, kind of had an 11-man rotation during this game, and so if I'm going against them, I'm playing Damian Lillard, of course, still starters minutes, but I'm doing my best to make sure that he is on the floor every second Chris Paul is not, while still giving him starter minutes, and just basically using Doc's rigidity against him. And that's something every team should do.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, although I think it was more the traps even than Paul, though Paul did very well. The few times that Dame tried to just take him one-on-one did not end well for him at all. I think that the Blazers are still going to be heard from in this series. I think that the way that Blake looks, which was very good, is going to be a problem for them trying to go small. They just don't have any other bigs. Vonleh is not the answer, obviously. They're just going to have to deal with him. What I was thinking they could try, and on one possession, actually, I was thinking this beforehand, but then one possession kind of confirmed it. I think Gerald Henderson would be their best choice, maybe other than Aminu, and maybe even including Aminu, to guard Blake Griffin. Henderson, obviously, you know, is a 2-3, but he is really strong. He can, and Blake's not the kind of guy who's going to, you know, shoot a turnaround jumper over a shorter guy. Like, he wants to back in, use his power, and get right to the cup on these plays. So, and the one time Blake tried to do that, Henderson was able to bump him off his hook shot and force him into kind of a wild shot going across the lane, more closer to like the dotted line than the restricted area. And so I might go with that, and then that could free up Aminu to maybe guard Chris Paul. Then you can switch stuff with Paul and Griffin, or you can switch stuff with Paul and DeAndre, okay, although getting Plumlee on Paul is probably no good. But, yeah, I mean, the stuff involving Paul and Griffin, you could switch if you have Aminu and Henderson on those two guys, and then maybe get Crabb some more time on Paul as well. But, yeah, Lillard and McCollum, not up to the task on either of those guys. But that said, I think with that, getting some better options on short rolls to beat the trap, you know, just practicing that, that's I think Portland can do better. And they're still, you know, I think they have a great home court advantage. I think they can still at least get this one to six by winning a couple at home, maybe.
Yeah, and I think that what the weekend, one of the kind of themes for it is something that we all, I think we knew, but to get it confirmed, was that the top teams in the West are really good. And Portland had a wonderful season. They were a nice surprise, but they're not as good as the Clippers at full strength. And I don't think that's really a surprise. They can absolutely still win some games in the series. I fully expect them to. But these top four teams were far separated from everybody else for a reason.
Yeah, and Blake, you know, I thought this would be close because I didn't think Blake was going to be there yet. And based at least on this one game, he was there. The Clippers' two-point shooting was unbelievable through, like, the competitive portion of the game. They're 34 of 56 on two-pointers. And the Blazers actually really encouragingly shut down their three-point game. Only 2 3-point attempts in the first half, none of which they made. 2 of 10 overall for the game. J.J. Redick was, he only played 22 minutes. He's got that bruised heel. He was abusing C.J. McCollum coming off his screens, but there were twos, and I think you just got to kind of live with those if you're Portland and not overreact unless you start hitting threes, and maybe the heel was part of why he felt more comfortable shooting a two-point jumper than a three. Jamal Crawford shot it pretty well today on like some of those running, you know, 15-footers. Those aren't necessarily that great of shots either. I thought actually the defense for the Blazers was reasonably good, considering the individual matchup problems that they had. The biggest thing that gives me concern that I just don't think they have an answer for is DeAndre Jordan. Like, their centers just got destroyed in this game.
Yeah, and you look at it, and, you know, Plumlee only played 19 minutes in this game, but I don't think that him playing more really, I mean, it's not that he was bad, but I don't think that makes them markedly better.
I think Aminu and Harkless can hit some more shots. That's another thing that might help for Portland. Another note I had, too, is that Cole Aldrich, what he's giving them right now, is a massive, massive upgrade on what they were getting from guys like Big Baby in last year's playoffs, or even, and I don't recall that they really went small at the four either. You know, they kind of have this rotating cast of characters. They got nothing from Jeff Green, nothing from Paul Pierce, nothing from Wes Johnson, nothing from Bamute on offense. The Blazers have got to be more aggressive in making those guys beat them, certainly. But, you know, Aldrich adds a dimension defensively that they did not have. And the Clippers' defense was just absolutely outstanding through the competitive portion of the game. The Blazers shot 34%, and, you know, I felt like that they earned that pretty well, other than the fact that, like, some guys just weren't hitting threes.
I'm taking immense personal satisfaction in the fact that we're only talking about the competitive portion of this game.
Yeah, apparently they started hacking with, like, 6 minutes left, down 20.
Yep.
That's great. Hopefully this will be the siren song of that strategy. All right, that will do it for today. Marathon first 8 games of the playoffs in the books. No classics yet, unfortunately. I think the East, we'll still see some from that. I'm looking really forward to that Raptors-Pacers game, with the Raptors basically now their season on the line after losing game 1 tomorrow. We will be at Warriors-Rockets game 2, and then Dallas-Oklahoma City. I'm rooting for a blowout, so we won't really have to talk about that game watch it at 11 in the morning or 11 at night once we get back from the Warrior game. Also, don't forget to fill out that survey. This is the last day that we're going to run it, but we've gotten great responses so far. We're actually pretty close to beating that 8% response rate on the high end. If we can get up to like 10%, that would be amazing. That's something that I can take to sponsors that they'll be really, really happy with. So that's podsurvey.com/capspace. And of course, don't forget about our friends at Indochino and, of course, Vistaprint as well. Do the survey. Talk to y'all next time.